I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with midwifery business consultation, and I have Carolyn Geiger and Hillary Schlinger here. We've done a few interviews together. We've talked about the past history of midwifery, where we think it'll go in the future. And I wanted to do one of like the present. There's so many exciting things going on, and I had to politely pause Hillary and all her exciting updates and said, let's just introduce and hit record so you can start talking more, Hillary. Just all the research opportunities for midwives out there. So take it away, Hillary.
Well, I was telling Leslie and Carolyn before we started recording that I spent over an hour this morning on the phone with somebody who does research in midwifery. This started out because I will be doing an upcoming webinar at GYN Zone on November 8th. That started also from a conversation, and the conversation was looking at perineal, intact perineums versus not. And in one of their advertisements for their webinars, they quoted a statistic that 95% of women have some sort of perineal injury during birth.
Yep, and their guide zones from Denmark area, and so I want
From
to give like the
Denmark.
international like guide zones been around since 2008, and we've been expanding them more in the U.S. space, and so you and I have connected with them and just been surprised by the difference in statistics.
Right. So I wrote to the woman from GYN Zone, Katrine, and I said, my gosh, that looks nothing like the stats that we took out of the MANA stats database, which tracked over 100,000 out-of-hospital births attended by midwives. And so then she wrote me back, which I think the statistic was more like 40%. I don't remember, it was 35 or 45. I'd have to look back of people who had intact perineums. And is a perineums the when you when there, or is a perinea? Anyway, perineums. And she said, well, do you think that those midwives aren't inspecting it?
Yeah, so it was
And I said,
an
well,
assumption of educational class versus
right.
the
And I
actual
said, no,
outcome.
I don't think that that's it. I think that we are seeing birth differently. And so what I want to talk about and will be talking about is what happens with more undisturbed birth. What do we see? Well, I'm looking for research on that. And interestingly, the research is much more, I think, practitioner-based. Is it intervention, hands-on versus hands-off? Is it whether we do, the perineal support or not? Is it whether we flip a woman to her to sidelying versus so it's like a left
Efficiency.
lateral Sims? Is it hands and knees? What position you get people in? Is it directed versus undirected pushing? Whereas when I look at undisturbed birth, and I've been actually sitting and watching videos, all I can find of undisturbed births, what do women do? They actually do what I did in my own births. And this is what I wrote to her. And I said, I didn't want anyone to touch me. I put my own hands on my perineum. I got into a, for my first, a squatting, for my second, a kneeling position. That's what I see. What do women left alone, not directed in terms of what they should do in second stage? They actually provide their own first labial as the head comes under the pubic bone, and then perineal support. And it's often not the way that we would do it, where we're putting sort of continuous support all around. It's often pushing right where you see the occiput coming through, even if it's asynclitic, even if it's not in a perfect OA. And so this has started me thinking. I'm calling people. I called Anne Fry last night. I called this woman in Canada this morning who are researchers saying, do we have statistics on this? Is there any statistics on what happens in undisturbed birth in both second stage, where it is the client directed, not provider directed? what positions do women get into when given the choice? The other interesting thing that I saw in all these videos was that a lot of women actually change position between the birth of the head and the birth of the shoulders. And it might be as subtle as lifting their leg, but it might also be, I've watched women go from kneeling to hands and knees.
Well, and so, I think a lot of it is that instinctual birth, Hillary. It's that when you can put your guard down, like I've seen it with practicing hospital birth center home, when you truly have a good, strong relationship with the midwife, they're not disturbing the birth experience, how different the birth ends up. Like the women can really go internal. They can truly listen to their bodies. Yes. They can truly, that passive pushing that, okay, now they're starting to feel a burn. They're kind of half grunting and not doing the traditional, what you see in the hospital, like to be able to allow that instinctual birth to come out, what the outcomes are.
Right. Or as Michelle O'Donnell put it, the fetus ejection reflex. And what are the elements that are conducive to that? Right. Where it's the getting out of your neocortex, right? Mm-hmm. Allowing the flow of hormones as they're meant to be when we're undisturbed. Perhaps it's the, I often see in these videos that I've been watching is that when even the husband talks to his partner, it breaks that. Yeah. Let alone the midwife doing it. And we have to stop ourselves from saying things like, oh, you're doing such a good job, or, oh, you need to breathe. You know, that even those things takes people out of their head and takes them out of that instinctual birth. Mm-hmm. So that led to a conversation this morning on what else aren't we researching that we might be able to notice as midwives. So for instance, one of the things that I was very interested in, and actually I think about 15 years ago, I had contacted this woman for data and she sent it to me on those hard disks, right, that our computers don't even take anymore, the old between the big floppies and the small floppies, of what is the baby's position entering labor and how does that connect to whether or not we see a shoulder dystocia? More than the size of the baby, I was seeing that when you have a baby who enters labor in a posterior position and rotates mid or late labor, that you're more likely to end up with a shoulder dystocia. My theory being that the shoulders don't, especially with a large baby, but it can happen with small babies, is the shoulders don't totally rotate. And you end up with a torqued baby, and here's the torqued baby, and there's that anterior shoulder more likely to be way high up.
Well, I'm even thinking with Carolyn, because of her ultrasound experience, like thinking outside the box, having a comparison of a midwife doing a bedside ultrasound versus a physician, not just in the clinical outcome, but the client's perception, the education, the experience, the anxiety. Like, I think we don't give enough credit as us as midwives for the education and the calming nature and how we present things, like informed consent. That's a very biased direction of how you give it. And I think that sometimes, especially with the bedside ultrasound, what Carolyn does, I could see a lot of potential studies of us doing it versus a radiologist tech versus a physician doing it, like how that impact is on the client's perception.
It would be very interesting to look not just where's the head, but where's the baby, the whole
the words you use, the verbiage, yeah, like to change the scripting of, if you treat them as, instead of saying fetus, it's saying the baby and saying the baby's name and like those little etiquette things that we add.
So you're talking about the psychological, but I think for Carolyn, it's also the physical, is what can we learn, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which makes me think of a totally different situation where I was at a birth and we were seeing some really funky heart tones that let me, I knew there was cord involvement, and then the baby came out and it wasn't a cord around the neck. He was holding it in his hand and sucking on it.
Oh my. Now there's a different heart rate tracing, I'll tell you.
It sure was. It would go down to the 80s. And I think then what would happen is he probably got hypoxic enough he would let go. Relax. And it would bounce back. But so this midwife I was talking to in Ontario this morning said that the midwives there now who span home birth center and hospital birth were given very new ultrasound machines for their offices. And so how could we integrate that into some of the midwifery research, for example?
Oh, absolutely.
So she was interested in what she called reverse dilation. So that if you have somebody in a home birth or a birth center setting, and then they get transported, and often the midwife is told, oh, you must have been mistaken. She's not 8 centimeters, she's 6. But what is it with the changing environment that there actually is a phenomenon that I see Leslie?
Well, we even had it like this summer because there's instantly it was a question of, oh, the midwives or the nurses must be incompetent because the cervix can't go backwards. And I'm like, it's a sphincter. You make someone nervous, anxious, it clenches, like, come on.
Exactly. So all of the things that we could add to the research literature, if we think of these innovative ways and think beyond the randomized controlled trial. And that was another part of the conversation.
You know, there's some interesting research that's been done in Europe about process of labor and progression of dilatation and effacement and stuff. They're using ultrasound to do that transperineal and not doing bimanual exams. And they're able to really watch the cervix as it changes, as well as the descent. And they're not doing bimanuals anymore.
Or internal, digital.
Internal, right.
Yeah.
Right. So very interesting. I haven't learned a lot about that research yet, but I am anxious to.
Well, and I think there's just so much out there that, like Hillary, Carolyn and I were talking about, just the merging of the different educational backgrounds internationally, how much knowledge we have among us as midwives, and the hospital midwives can teach the birth center midwives and the home birth midwives and the educational backgrounds. Like, let's morph each other's skills and let's get some research behind it. Like, even just the subtle skills of a natural birth, since they're getting less and less in the hospital setting, to teach these labor support and these subtle cues and these things, like even just the simple thing of watching the hips, like these lost art things that should get some research and credibility behind them to be passed on to the mainstream medical system, not just you had the right midwifery trainer that had this knowledge that passed it on to you.
Exactly. Yeah, when you say about what people know, and I don't know if you know about the research on the purple line. Okay.
Well, Carolyn, there you go.
Yes. So this is some of the midwives are looking at when women are in an upright position, particularly, and you have access to being able to see their sacrum, and it actually is from their butt cheeks separating, right, is that you can see the progression of descent by watching what they call the purple line. And there is some research on utilizing it.
Yeah.
Oh, love hands and knees for birth. That is so wonderful.
And it can be hands and knees. It can be standing. It can be kneeling, as long as you have access to seeing that. And, you know, there's always this piece, this in the back of my mind. In 1984, I heard Sheila Kitzinger speak at a conference in Toronto, actually. She was one of the people who talked about this way back 84. I mean, what is that, 36 years, 37 years ago? And she talked about the about instinctual birth versus, as she put it in her very British way, everybody watching the perineum the way that they would the luggage carousel at the airport waiting for their baggage to come.
Oh, what a wonderful analogy. I love it.
Right. Right. So that's where my mind was going on research, but I'm sure that we can come up with loads of things that midwives could put forward. And then it's the idea of how do we put out the call? How do we collect the data? Again, you know, and this is what this woman this morning and I were talking about is you certainly can't, I can't see a way, just in the same way as we couldn't randomize people to home versus birth center versus hospital, is it's very hard to randomize who's going to have an instinctual birth or an upright birth versus not. But getting beyond the randomized controlled trial and recognizing that that data is important.
But I think it's even going to the basics of educating midwives. We're going to do observational statistics, but we're going to document to a level of detail we've never done before. Like, I think when we talk about all these ideas, midwives have great ideas. They want to make these inventions. They want to change the world, but we get overwhelmed because we're not trained researchers. We're not trained inventors. We're not trained business owners. Right. So I think if you could even go to the basics of what midwives with great research ideas could do, or how it could be even like who they would even talk to start a study. I think that's overwhelming to so many midwives.
Right, exactly. And it's where we also, you know, we can get back to education. Where do we put our focus in education? If you're getting a master's, should you be doing a research inquiry? How many midwives just get through their statistics classes and how many actually think about the application of them too. And it's not just your practice. As we do these things, there were people from 40 countries at this webinar yesterday. Think about the ripples that creates.
Well, and it's not just about creating research, but it's also analyzing, is there a conflict of interest? Yes. Is this legit? Is there biases? Like I made the mistake, I went through just the high level statistics, and it's not just about the idea of creating research studies, but okay, if we're reading the data on something's new, like I see it all the time. You're like, okay, I can tell who's a really good researcher or who just is reading this at face value because they don't know how to interpret the terms or the explanations of all this.
Think how it affects policy. I mean, take us back to the Lancet breach study that means that a whole generation of obstetricians never learned breech birth. All they learned was do a cesarean.
That's right. Absolutely. That changed the whole face of breech birth completely. Unfortunately. Right.
And the same with that really flawed WAC study on home birth.
Oh. And I taught him, obviously not very well.
Well, and we're seeing it now with what are the implications of the ARRIVE trial? You know, should we take at face value that everybody should be induced at 39 weeks? I don't think so. I look at Hensie Gore's rebuttal of it. Of how do you really evaluate the data? And she put that on a site called Science and Sensibility, you know? And yet I think that there are a lot of obstetric practices, let alone midwives who may be their guidelines may be influenced by what obstetricians are doing, who just said, oh, look, the study says we should be inducing everyone at 39 weeks. Well, what do the statistics really have to say when you parse them?
Yeah, like the low risk, the high risk, certain criterias and certain comorbidities. You don't just generalize everybody together.
Right, right. Who they considered low risk was some of Hensie Gore's analysis. How did people end up being hypertensive and yet still being in the, you know, being induced for hypertension, yet it's still being in the low risk category experiment control group data, right? Mm-hmm. So really parsing those things out and understanding that.
Yeah.
So
Well, I think with the knowledge, I think on a, just a day-to-day with midwives, having them advocate, like we don't with pregnant women and vulnerable populations want to be proactive and no, we're not going to do this to you, but this to you there. But I think the value of the observational data and getting midwives to challenge, not just legal defense, but also like historical advocacy for our little secrets and our tools of our trade that we notice and we assess for that maybe on a subconscious level, we're just not recognizing.
And so then to go all the way back to undisturbed birth or instinctual birth, it's not just the numbers to me, how many intact perineums do we see, but what about something like a grounded theory or a qualitative study on women's experience of that? Because what I observe is that undisturbed birth or minimally disturbed birth also results in feelings of empowerment, that then how does that translate to your parenting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That
I caught my baby or I needed the midwife or provider, like that level of I delivered my baby. I didn't need, they were there for support versus I am so grateful you were there. Thank you. Like that attitude.
Right. And it can happen in the hospital setting. I'm thinking about somebody who I was with for a hospital birth because of her particular situation. And we had a neonatologist in the room because of her particular situation, you know, with risk for the baby. And yet she gave birth on a birthing stool, baby put right on her chest. The neonatologist walked over right away to say, can I look at him? And the mama lion in him went, in her went, no, as in step back. Give me a minute. This is my baby. And, you know, she's contacted me recently just because she thought of me as her son turned 10. You know, that moment was so important to her.
Yeah. Interesting.
So Carolyn, I'm curious, like with especially being a program director and your years of experience, are there any topics you would love to see in research that we just haven't done or like a different angle that would be great to add to the list?
Well, I'll tell you, I was raised as a labor and delivery nurse in the years when we were really working hard to allow women to have unmedicated births. This was after scopolamine and all of that. This has been a while. And when our families were coming to us begging for natural birth at that point in time and for being able to experience their birth in their way. And so I learned a lot of how to really support women in labor and birth. And I find that, and I taught it in my classes as well. We went through a lot, but I don't think that that is standard. I think that has changed a tremendous amount. There's a lot of time spent on how to interpret a fetal monitor strip and not as much time on how to interpret how a woman is progressing through labor. And I mean, I've learned how to watch a woman and know what was going on and even practicing with relatively high risk patients and such in high risk hospital settings, that's how I managed labor and birth. And lots of people thought that I was like, how do you know that? And I'm like, how do you not know that? you need to.
But I think it's not just with the nurses, but the residents. It's just this lost generation. As you get more and more epidurals and you get more and more intervention, you're losing the hand skills. Like, it's always interesting to me, a lot of these places implementing, okay, we need to do an ultrasound at 36 weeks. We need to do an ultrasound when the woman arrives at the labor delivery unit. I'm like, I'm very confident with my Leopold and my exams and my skill set, but I've also had the opportunity over extensive years to, that's only skill. Like, you don't have it down the hallway. You don't have, you think differently when you don't have that cushion of, well, I got to back up. Well, if my hands aren't quite sure, I'm just going to go get this. Like, if you don't confident, you've now got an unplanned breach at home. Like, you got to know your skill.
When I was running the Fetal Assessment Center at Hopkins, I used to have an ongoing deal with the residents that I would do Leopold's and they would do, and they would also do the Leopold's, but and we kept track of it, and I won
a lot.
You know,
it's also listening to mothers. You know, I'm sitting here thinking that maybe I said this in a previous recording we did about a woman who was seeing a perinatologist because of severe preeclampsia. And she said something to him about the baby being breech. And he said to her, how do you know with that ultrasound? And she said, because I'm being kicked in the cervix.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I think just giving the credibility of the woman's subjective assessment is actually an objective, like, even though it's not our hands telling us, it's actually her body telling. Like, I think that level of when they say they're feeling something, or like if they say baby's coming, I'd hear that all the time where they're so stoic and they come through labor delivery and the mom's saying the baby's coming, everybody's like, yeah, okay. I'm like, yeah, that baby's, like, we don't give enough credibility to her assessment of her body many times.
Learned that my first day in labor and delivery, that when mom says the baby is coming, it's coming till I prove otherwise. And my head nurse said, I just checked her, she was 4 centimeters, that baby's not coming, and go back in there and stay with her. And I came back to the door and said, Teresa, because the baby had just been born. And That was my first day in labor and delivery, and I have never forgotten it.
Right. I'm sitting here even thinking about my grandson's birth. And when she was in the shower and all of a sudden screamed, gotta poop. Mm-hmm. And she's running for the toilet and we're going, you know, she's getting out of the shower on the toilet. And it's like, I think it's the baby, you know, and that is what often happens. So when you were talking about what new midwives are seeing and that they're not seeing that, what it made me think of was people who have taken the trend in a different direction. So, for instance, there's a man named Abraham, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, Verghese, who's at Stanford, and he reinstituted teaching what was he called the Stanford 10, and it's now up to the Stanford 20. What he was alarmed by was medical students losing their physical examination skills. And I use those Stanford videos in teaching.
Oh,
how do you do a really thorough thyroid exam, right? Mm-hmm. With your hands, not with what it's
simulators and a virtual course. And yeah, you're
right. And so he wanted to bring back the art of the physical exam to medical students. And I think in the same way, we need to bring back the art of observing, not doing, observing labor.
Well, even it's just the school criteria, and part of it's malpractice, part of it's like, I had to work really hard in midwifery school to get out of hospital experience. Some of the programs, you can't even do it as a choice. And I think it should be the reverse. You're going to graduate. You have to have not just 40, 60, 80 births, but they have to be in each setting. Like, you're required to get it. It's the reverse versus restricting the clinical opportunities. We need to be expanding them into those different settings.
Yeah, I don't think it's setting though. I think, okay, so this is, what is different in the home birth or birth center setting is you're not relying on technology to monitor the mother or baby. And so she's not, she doesn't have her blood pressure cuff and the fetal monitor, so the contract. So what did you have, Carolyn? You had, but back in the day before those things were universal, is you had one-on-one care. You had the nurse or the midwife in the room.
With, exactly was, right. Exactly yeah. right. Then this is because you're right. That was before we had universal epidurals and before we had fetal monitors. Shocking. But we learned to listen with the left scope or
the fetoscope and the doctor.
Yeah.
And we did every 15 minute listening to the heart rate and you know what, when we started using the fetal monitors, the C-section rate went up. So and that was a pretty quick transition, actually.
And there is good research that's actually supports that. So bringing back the art of intermittent auscultation for low risk labors and births.
Yes, absolutely. We should be doing that. And we should be, you know, pressing that so much more. And that will be a transition that changes nursing a lot. Nursing is in great part responsible for keeping women in bed and with monitors on. I remember ordering intermittent auscultation and then going in and keep taking off that monitor. And the nurse says, but I have to know what's going on. All you have to do is listen every 15 minutes. It's very easy.
And especially in the days of Dopplers, is you certainly can listen through a contraction beginning
right
before it starts, through the contraction to afterwards, to see if there are late D cells. I don't need a monitor to tell me that.
Right. 100%.
Well, yeah. And I think when we're talking about research opportunities for midwives, too many midwives think, okay, it's too big. I got to do it on a national level. I got to do it large scale. We have a lot of midwives that maybe there wasn't midwifery opportunities in their communities and they became clinical nurse specialists, educators. Like, there's so many opportunities on units to do the research and change things on a small scale, not just the big, big scale we're talking about. Like, I think it's just inspiring midwives to think differently. There's so much data. There's so much knowledge out there. We just have to document it a little differently. We have to collect the data for our reports a little differently and to advocate objectively the differences and be able to understand them to compare.
Well, it would even be good just to see a lot more focus on implementing research, such as making sure that baby goes skin to skin with the mom for their first hour of birth. You know, that research has been done and documented. What we need to do is break those habits of taking that baby away as soon as it's born. Drives me nuts. And I drove the nurses nuts because they were saying, can I take the baby? I'm like, not on your life.
Well, and I think the same thing with delayed cord clamping. Haven't we done enough research to say, gosh, we see a difference at 4 months on iron levels in the babies. So can you wait 3 minutes? You know,
Well, part of it is not just the challenge of having the research, like Hillary, as you're talking about the delayed cord clamping. All I'm thinking of is this evaluation I had at a hospital I worked at for 3 months. And I'm like, I wish I could have recorded it, like telling me, I know the evidence is out there, but our pediatricians do it this way. Like, how do you break through when you're the provider and you don't have credentialing rights for the newborn? And where is that gray line when there's the cord's not cut? When is it, when are they one unit and when are they separate? Like, it's hard, even if the research is out there. How do the midwives advocate for it? It's not just for them and the client and patient they're serving. There's multi-disciplines that maybe have higher authority and power in the system that you now have to, not just the nurses. So yeah, it's challenging.
Oh, I've been listening to a friend of mine who's a midwife at a local hospital, and she's actually doing her PhD DNP right now. And her project that she's working on has to do with doing the WHO recommended 2-hour glucose, single 2-hour glucose testing versus the 2-step 1-hour, then followed by a 3-hour GTT. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that the 2-hour is diagnostic. It's not a screening test. Right. And yet, she has recently had a maternal fetal medicine doc who's seeing this patient of hers because the woman is very high BMI, and the MFM guy is totally convinced that this woman must have GDM, which she, according to the 2-hour, doesn't, and he wants her to repeat it. And she said, it's a diagnostic test. It's not a screening test. So she's tussling with, well, the MFM doc is telling her to do this. And he's like, he doesn't understand. This is a diagnostic test. You know, so it's in these subtle ways of all of the layers of hierarchy that are contained within that system.
Right, right. So just being able to implement the really excellent studies that are already done, well proven, like you say, cord clamping, baby staying with moms, the diabetic studies, there's no question that they're that we're overdoing this completely. But it does take such systematic change. But that's what a DNP is about, implementing research and being able to make changes in a system. We need to be putting that to work.
Well, I think any midwife can do it as long as we're documenting what we're doing. And like I loved it, even my little tiny birth center, ACNM, I competed with the big dogs and submitted my stats and my statistics, and you get awards and recognition. So I think it's not just the midwives documenting really well, having some good statistics they're already collecting that they can submit to these bigger databases. So we can advocate for any setting and any educational background. Because if you're doing all these wonderful things underground and in your own little world, but it's not being spread to the masses, How do we learn from that?
Yeah. Oh, and I'm not saying that only DNPs can do this. I'm just saying that in great part, that's part of the reason for the DNP, because I personally still don't see a lot of reason for it, but I'm a little old fashioned. So, but if anything, being able to utilize research and put it into effect is supposed to be one of the keystones of getting a DNP. So let's do it. All right. But any of us can do that.
Well, and there's a difference between submitting data and being the one who then puts it all together as part of a research project. So I was a participant in collecting data for a study, and that as far, I may have spoken with you about this before, but I got interested in Lyme disease, and I did because of my family being affected, and even to the point where my granddaughter is cord blood positive for Lyme. I collected cord blood from her because we looked at vertical transmission. So I got far afield with it, but I did participate in a study that was done in three countries. It was the US, Canada, and Australia. And because I was doing women's health, I started collecting semen samples and vaginal swabs. And I thought that I was collecting. For Lyme. And one of the people in my study, who was, I thought was going to be a control group, came up positive on testing in Australia. And I went back to her and I said, well, this is really interesting, but you test positive using the Australian labs, whatever their lab was, for Lyme antibodies. And she said, oh, that's interesting. I spent many months in Australia, and she told me when it had been. And what we were doing is we were looking to see, because it's a spirochete, could we find it in vaginal swabs and semen samples, which would be the first step in saying, well, it's a spirochete. Can it be sexually transmitted?
Right.
Very interesting.
And we found it in both vaginal swabs and semen samples of people who were positive for Lyme, which is food for thought, right?
Yeah. There you go. You got a whole nother direction. You'll be the Lyme STD transmission expert.
But I guess back to is I just collected samples in the same way as a midwife who says, well, I'm not research savvy, but you can still collect data and then give it to somebody else who is collecting it from a number of people. You can participate, even if it's in that small way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I love this topic greatly. And what I would like to do, because we have a couple other topics, pause this recording and leave them in a series. Because if we do about 2 hours, our poor audience is going to be a little lost. So I think I'm going to pause and then we'll put the next video out for them in a couple of weeks. So thank you both for being here.
Oh, this is great. Thanks.
Thank you.